Well, hey everyone, this episode of The Vinyl Guide is sponsored by the best record cleaner on earth, the Groove Washer. Records rotate, they generate static electricity, and that attracts dust, dirt, and debris, which detracts from the sound and ruins your stylus. The Groove Washer record cleaner fixes all of that, helps them sound better, and makes your gear last longer. Ask for the Groove Washer by name or go to groovewasher.com and use promo code VinylGuide10 for a 10% discount on everything from groovewasher.com. That's groovewasher.com, promo code VinylGuide10. And this week we are also sponsored by AudiophileUSA.com, the family-owned and operated record shop that only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. With over 42,000 titles in stock, AudiophileUSA.com ships worldwide. If your record shop is closed or you can't find that final upgrade to that special vinyl title, check out AudiophileUSA.com, sign up for their mailing list, and get first dibs on all new arrivals. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. And with that, let's get into this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Hey, this is Beto O'Rourke in El Paso, Texas, with Powered by People, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here, host of The Vinyl Guide. I hope you're well. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who subscribes to The Vinyl Guide podcast. And of course, a huge thanks to all our patrons of the show. And of course, everyone who shares these episodes on social media. That is huge. Please keep doing that. And to our U.S. listeners, happy Labor Day. Hope you're all well, enjoying your three-day weekend up there. Hope you're all behaving yourselves and being good to one another. Boy, it looks hot. I hope all your air conditioning machines still work as well. And speaking of the U.S., this week our special guest is former U.S. Congressman and punk rock enthusiast Beto O'Rourke. Now, most listeners in the United States will already know a bit about Beto. For the rest of you, here's a quick primer. In 2018, Beto, a native Texan, shot to political fame by running a famously non-traditional political campaign at almost impossible odds and came very, very close to unseating Republican incumbent Ted Cruz. Now, Texas has been a Republican stronghold for decades, so this was by no means a small feat. And recently, Beto also ran a campaign for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States, citing much of the same playbook he used for his 2018 Texas Senate run. But interestingly, that playbook draws heavily on the paths and ethos that Beto learned from his time touring in a punk band, making records, and from his absorption of ideas and tactics from such record labels as Discord, Epitaph, SST, and more. So today, we talk to Beto about the influence that punk had on him as an individual and how those records and artists shaped his life and political outlook. Now, I want to be straight with everyone here. The Vinyl Guide is not and has never been a political show. We've always been about music, collecting, and enjoying some of the best art ever made. And I rarely talk about politics, but I do have opinions. And I need to warn you, today's episode has a fair amount of them. I'm quite aware many of our listeners do not share all of my views, and may even grow uncomfortable at some of the assertions and conversation points. But I'm going to trust that we still have enough in common to be okay and to continue to move on together. Now, if you find yourself unable to, well, that's fine. Take a break, or if this is goodbye, well, that's your decision. But having a civil discourse is how we learn and grow. And that's really what I want to make sure we're all clear that these are the rules of the game. It's okay to think differently than one another, but we could do it productively and with civility. Now, normally, this show features discussions with artists, producers, record label heads, so it may seem like having Beto O'Rourke on the show is a bit outside of our normal sphere. However, if we consider that Beto's a music fan, was in a punk band, made a record which is quite rare, and is a very interesting individual, well, to me, that's just ticked off all the boxes for what I look for in a guest. So I don't think any of you will be disappointed in what Beto shares today from a music and human experience perspective. Some listeners may think, well, Nate, you live in Australia. Why are you concerned on U.S. politics? And that's a fair question. I am from the U.S. originally. I still have a lot of family and friends there, many of whom I don't agree with on a number of issues. But that's okay. I love them all the same. And I also care about their well-being, their health, their safety, and their comfort. These are very scary times, which Beto and I talk about, and how he deals with that, how he stays motivated, how he's inspired by music, punk and beyond. We talk about Beto's first punk record, which was so pivotal in his life, he still remembers the name of the person that gave it to him. We talk about the lessons that Beto learned on the road with his band, and how they translated into key differentiators on the campaign trail. And finally, we talk about what each of us can do to help take things back into our hands and grow the country and the world in a productive manner. Now, it's now Labor Day in the USA, which means we are now in the final stretch of the 2020 presidential election. The time to make your voice heard is now, and Beto's strategy is quite sound. He'll explain it. Texas is a key battleground state, which he nearly flipped in 2018, and with a bit of help, it can be taken all the way. And then we can look towards a fair and balanced representation and moral leadership within the United States. So check out poweredxpeople.org. Volunteer some time in the coming weeks and do your part to ensure a restoration of moral leadership in the White House, which is really the first step to then take things beyond. I'm volunteering. I would encourage you all to do the same. That's Powered by People or poweredxpeople.org. And with that, let's talk to the punk rock politician himself, Mr. Beto O'Rourke. Good.
Now, I don't see you. Am I not supposed to see you?
And is that better? You can see me if you want.
Why not? Hey,
sure.
I like that.
Okay. All right. So let's talk some records and music, yeah? Now, I've heard you being referred to as the punk rock politician. Is that a phrase you embrace?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I think about punk rock, I think about women and men in the 1970s and 1980s and really all the way through today, trying to get rock and roll back to its roots, back to what was essential, dangerous, subversive, and cool. And, you know, if someone wants to apply that label to me, you know, I'd gladly embrace it. But, you know, I think there's something that applies to politics. You know, if punk rock was trying to get rock and roll back to its roots and freed from corporate control and what was safe for radio and getting back to just people telling their stories to one another and opening up, you know, rock music to anybody who could get their hands on a guitar or some drumsticks, and you didn't have to be, you know, a proficient prog rocker. You didn't have to fill stadiums. You didn't have to have, you know, a spectacular light show and outfit. You just had to have the guts to get out there. I think that, you know, our politics and our democracy is kind of hitting a similar test. I mean, it costs so much to be a candidate right now and to put yourself out there, and the consultants and the focus groups and, you know, the testing of the messaging and the talking points, the polls, all that stuff. It's corporate politics, like we had and still have corporate rock and roll. And when you can get past that and get down to the roots of democracy, which is just really one person connecting with another person about where they jointly want to see their community or their state or their country go, and then making a commitment to work on that together. That's transcendent and powerful and amazing. And when you're doing that right, you're doing democracy right. Just like when I think you're doing rock and roll right, getting back to its roots. And it doesn't mean, you know, being hokey and having to do things in an old fashioned way, just getting to the essence of what it's all about. You know, that's what I aspire to. And that's what really excites me and turns me on, whether it's music or politics or anything else.
Yeah. There's this earnestness that you really can't fake. And I've seen that in your political approach. Some people today seem to be intimidated by it and by anything that's authentic. And it's not because it's bad. It's just because we're really not used to it anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, to me at least, inherently exciting when you listen to someone who's not practiced in their speech. In other words, they didn't have what they're saying written for them by someone else. It hasn't been pre-approved or tested. It doesn't fit, you know, whatever the public sentiment is at the moment to a T. It is someone's genuine thoughts expressed genuinely by them. And that is so rare in politics today that it can't help but get your attention. And I've got to think about, you know, going back to punk rock, you know, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, or Richard Hell, or the Ramones, what that must have sounded like at the time when your ears had grown so accustomed to this rapidly converging consensus on what was safe to put into a song, what was safe to say in a song, and how long a song should be, and the way that that song should be performed. And to have people bust through all that must have been just so thrilling and so exciting, and still thrilling to me today. I was just listening actually to a Richard Hell album, and it's, you know, however many years later, almost 50 years later, it still connects in a very powerful way. And I would love our politics to be more like that. And I think you find the candidates and the politicians and the office holders who have that authenticity. I think of a Bernie Sanders. That stuff is transcendent. It connects regardless of how young or old you are, or how many times you've been around the block. There's something really exciting about him and his message, because it is honest and it is authentic and it is raw. And so, you know, you can find that in our politics today.
Yeah. Bernie is very punk rock.
He is. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the pivotal music for you in your life, I heard you talk about your love for The Clash. Describe for me what your record collection was like as a teenager in your early 20s.
Yeah. So as a kid, my mom had all these Beatles records. And I remember learning how to use the record player, you know, in third or fourth grade, and putting on Magical Mystery Tour and just spending the entire day with it and listening to and learning the songs, learning the words to the songs, and also just the beautiful packaging of that record. All these beautiful glossy photos of the Beatles in white tuxedos, and all of them have, you know, a red rose on their lapel, except for Paul, who of course has a black rose on his lapel. What the hell does that mean? And
he was dead. Haven't you heard the rumors? He was.
Right. I came late to that conspiracy theory, but I mean, just so fascinating to me that this world that was opened up to me by listening to this. And then, yeah, in eighth grade, my buddy Arlo Clar, in, you know, eighth grade English class, hands me a cassette of London Calling. And I took that home, and it just stayed in the tape deck for, you know, the next year, and really forever changed my life. It seemed as essential and beautiful and, you know, opening up worlds like the Beatles had done for me, just in a different way and at a different age. And then going to my first punk rock show, which might have been the Descendants, and it may have been one of the last tours before they became, some of the members became all, seeing them play at the Mesa Inn in El Paso, Texas, you know, with 300 other kids. And all of a sudden, there were people who were not that much older than me, who were not on a big, ornate, elaborate stage, who were like, you could get right up in their face, they could get right up in your face. And there was this extraordinary connection between the audience and the band, and the energy was off the charts. You felt it in every part of your body. And it was the most exhilarating, exciting, dangerous, crazy thing I'd ever had a chance to be a part of in all of my 15 years of existence. And so that really began to shape the records that I sought. So I would buy Maximum Rock and Roll, which was kind of like the Bible of American punk rock on a weekly basis, and order out of the back pages there. I would go to the Headstand, which was this head shop on Dyer Street in the northeast of El Paso, which really was the only shop that had any records that you could get that you would want. And, you know, began to buy up the Discord Records catalog, the SST Records catalog, the Twin Tone. You know, I would start to identify these labels that were putting out amazing music. And, you know, I know a band on the label like Black Flag on SST and loved their records. And I would just start to buy anything I saw with the SST stamp on the back. So I discovered this band, Slovenly, which no one had heard of and maybe no one has heard of since, but love some of their stuff, like the song Cartwheels of Glory, which I just think is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. The Leaving Trains, fronted by Falling James, whose records I bought and who I got to see in DC when they were on tour. And I was a 18-year-old intern serving for a congressman. And I told all my friends in the office, you got to come see the Leaving Trains. They're the best band you've never heard of. And we show up, and you know, the four of us who show up comprise about half of the audience that's there to see the Leaving Trains. And the Leaving Trains go on to put on one of the best shows I've ever seen, as though they were playing to Wembley Arena and there were, you know, 30,000 of us out there. Just everything they had, including, you know, getting totally naked by the end of the show, and they were having the best time of their lives. And anyhow, so all these records from all these labels that helped to tell the story of all these different communities across the United States. And then perhaps most impactful was picking up the Discord Records catalog out of Washington, D.C. And, you know, Minor Threat and Rites of Spring, Henry Rollins' first band, State of Alert, SOA, just geeking out and diving as deep as I could into the punk rock history of that town and all the players who all became heroes to me. And this idea that, again, people not too much older than I was could start their own label and put out their own records and book their own tours and write their own songs and create something that other young people could be a part of, that didn't have to be, you know, on the radio or part of corporate culture or handed down to you. You can make it for yourself. That was an epiphany for me and really kind of shaped the music that I sought and pursued. And then down the road, you know, some of the things that we did, like starting a band, starting a label, you know, going on tour around the country. Really huge influence on my life.
So talk to me about that transition, because you went from listener to participant. What was it that had you turn that corner and pick up an instrument and want to contribute?
You know, there was something that was just fundamental to the bargain, that every member of the audience was potentially, or maybe certainly, a member of a band or a future member of a band. I mean, we could all do this. Three chords, you know, whatever you're feeling, you shout it, scream it, or sing it out. And there's an audience there of your peers, other outcasts, weirdos, geeks, and strangers who were in for the bargain. And this is going to be a little bit of a stretch, but bear with me. I'm listening to this podcast on the history of the English language, and it's taken us to the roots in the Proto-Indo-European language. And one of the things I learned by listening to this is that the word for give and the word for take are the same root word. And the word for guest and the word for host are the same root word. And there's something about the duality of being the, you know, the recipient of a gift and the giver of a gift, the receiver of hospitality and the giver of hospitality, that's at play in punk rock. You are going to be the audience and you're going to give respect to that band, but then you're also going to be the band the next night. Folks are going to be sleeping on your floor or on your couch when they come to your town. You're going to be sleeping on their floor and their couch when you go through their town. So there was this really beautiful democratic, if that's the right word, ethic, where no one was really above anyone else. And everyone had the potential, maybe the expectation, to put their own stuff out there. I mean, we started a little zine called Solid, where we would interview artists and write short stories and poems and put that out there. And then we, a few of us, Mike, Arlo, Cedric, and I, started a band called Foss. And in order to book the tour and get gigs at, you know, bars and clubs and basements and church halls all over the country and in Canada, you know, they needed to hear something. And so we recorded a tape and sent the cassette out. And then the next year, before the next tour, recorded a 7-inch record and started sending that around. And we needed a label. And we had played a show in Calgary, Canada, and someone had given us a Western breed or Western breeder's hat, you know, maybe a cattle rancher up there. And we loved the hat, we loved the name. And so we came back to El Paso and started Western Breed Records. And we put out the first Foss 7-inch. And then Western Breed would, I think next release was At the Drive-In, their first 7-inch. But that was in keeping with what, you know, Greg Ginn was doing at SST, what Ian MacKay and Jeff Nelson were doing at Discord, what all these other labels had done in their community. We wanted a label in El Paso that was going to share with the rest of the world what the El Paso sound was. Mm. So that was kind of the evolution of the idea.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because as part of a community, the cost of being part of that community is having you also participate in it. You can't just be a bystander. It sounds like Discord was probably the blueprint that you guys followed.
Yeah. I mean, insofar as we were able to follow anything. I mean, I don't know if Western Breed released, you know, more than 2 or 3 records, and it was always more a concept or a vehicle than it was an end in itself.
There's about 11 records on it, by the way, on Western Breed. There's almost a dozen.
Are there? Okay. Yeah. So, and it was, what was funny is it was, I don't know if it was ever formally incorporated, at least it wasn't while I was a part of it. And it was really something owned by the community of bands that we were playing with. Cedric and Mike and Arlo and I might've started it, but it was, you know, at least as far as I was concerned, open for anyone to grab and use and take and run with it. And looks like some people did from what you told me. Yeah.
Oh, it's like an open source record label.
Totally.
So let's talk about Foss. Now, you released a 7-inch, which is quite a rare record these days. How many 7-inches did you get pressed up?
I wish I could remember, and I wish I still had some, because I've seen, you know, especially when, you know, I was running for Senate in Texas, and especially when Cedric was at the height of his fame with, you know, Mars Volta and At the Drive-In. Mm-hmm. You know, on eBay, you'd see that record going for $500. And so I wish I still had
You don't even have one copy. You don't even have one.
I've got one, and I don't even know if I've got the sleeve for it. I think I just literally have the 7-inch record. Did we press 500? Did we press 1,000? I don't know. It wouldn't have been more than 1,000. And mm-hmm. You know, I remember when we would, the summer we toured after we released that record and kind of sent it around, you know, you'd play your show and then the next morning you'd go to the record store and see if they had any of your records in stock and if they wanted to buy some more. And, oh, by the way, we have some in this, Plymouth station wagon that we're touring in that, you know, you can buy off of us. But I also love, there was a very... kind of a barter economy at these punk rock shows where, you know, you set up a little table to sell the records and the t-shirts and whatever merchandise you hauled with you. And sometimes folks didn't have money, but they'd trade the t-shirt that they were wearing for one of yours or a record of a band that they were in that they had just put out in their community. And would you trade records? Absolutely. we'd take that every time. Really, our goal in every show we played was just to make enough money to be able to afford to get to the next town, to put enough gas in the tank. And we were pretty self-sufficient in terms of what we ate and how we made our meals. And we brought a little, you know, stove with us and cooked rice and beans along the way. And then you also recognize how generous people are that you meet, who let you stay in their house or insist on feeding you dinner. And so, you know, it was a wonderful, wonderful way to spend a couple of years. And though, you know, I was never good enough to do this as a career, it's something that's always stayed with me. I've never stopped listening to music or being excited by music, or wanting to go out and see people perform it live, although that's obviously really hard to do right now.
Well, you know, you may not have that musician strength, but you certainly are comfortable touring and getting on a stage and speaking to people. Even though you don't have an instrument, you've got the microphone. So what did you learn from those early tours that you were able to bring into your political life?
You know, when we ran for Senate in Texas and we started out in early 2017, I mean, no one gave us a chance, in large part because no one knew who the hell I was. You know, though I was a member of Congress representing my hometown of El Paso and, you know, grateful for that opportunity and really enjoying the work, I was not well known. And, you know, my challenge running against Ted Cruz, one of the most well-known people in the United States and certainly very well-known in the state of Texas, running against him in a state that had last elected a Democrat to the Senate in 1988, we really had our work cut out for us. And we also, though, in some ways had nothing to lose. And my wife, who is, you know, not a fan of politics and is, you know, pretty proper in the language that she uses, I remember she kind of set the ethic for the campaign when we were first conversation we had about it. And she kind of summed it up and she said, fuck it. You know, just fuck it. Like, just do, you don't need to poll. You don't need anybody's permission. You don't have to be the anointed one. Why don't you just get out there and meet people? And I got to tell you, it felt very punk rock just getting in my car and driving due east, because we're in the westernmost county of Texas. So the 254, we are the 254th, the only one in the mountain time zone. So driving east and going up into the Panhandle, into Lubbock, where, you know, Buddy Holly and the Crickets are from, and the Flatlanders are from, and these great bands that I loved growing up. But a place in, or a part of Texas that had last seen a Democrat, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, and just showing up and sitting down in a Mexican restaurant, inviting anyone from the community who wants to come out to say hello, you know, no staff, no aides, no, just me showing up in my vehicle to your town to tell my story and listen to yours, man, if that didn't feel like traveling the country when we were touring in a punk rock band, I don't know what does, because you have no clue whether two people are going to show up or 20 or 200. And that's about the way it went. You know, it'd be two people the first time I'd come to your town, it'd be 20 the next time, you know, and by the end of the campaign, we did a rally with Willie Nelson in Austin, Texas at Auditorium Shores, and 60,000 people showed up for that. It just became so big, but it happened because we put in the work. And it happened because we did it the right way, right? It wasn't me, certainly wasn't the candidate, and it wasn't the party to which I belonged. It was just all these great people who formed a community around this race and this campaign and this opportunity for Texas to do this impossible thing. And it really brought out the best in people, their creativity. It was an open sourced campaign. So, you know, people would take the idea and the ethic of the campaign, and then they would, you know, make their own t-shirts or their own yard signs or do their own thing with it, make their own commercials for us and, you know, get them out there on the internet or air them. It was just a wonderful experience. And by the time the campaign got a little bit bigger, we were traveling in a Dodge Grand Caravan, and there were three of us, Cynthia, Chris, and myself. And I drove every single mile of that, just as I tried to drive as many miles as I could. And we were touring in a punk rock band. It would be either me or Mike, because neither Arlo nor Cedric really drove much at that time. So I just loved getting behind the wheel, putting some music on, getting to the next town, and being surprised by the people who would show up and the connections that we would make, and never having a script or talking points. Just every town hall, every meeting in every community was a town hall. So it was really just a mutual engagement where I'm going to talk for a little while and I'm going to listen to you for a long while. And we're going to leave with a better appreciation of what's possible. That was so hard, so much fun, so exciting, and so inspired by that DIY attitude and approach of punk rock. And one of my favorite bands about, or favorite books about that era is Get in the Van by Henry Rollins. I mean, Black Flag, they literally charted the path that so many other punk bands would follow. They found the places you could play in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, in El Paso, Texas. And they kind of, you know, blazed that trail that other bands from other labels would follow. And it was just extraordinary, tedious, day in, day out, grinding hard work that made their success possible. And I kind of adopted that as, you know, the ethic that I wanted to campaign with, which is we are going to go to every one of these 254 counties, and many of them we're going to go to many times over. We're going to, in some days, visit 8 different counties in a day, and we'll have to drive between, you know, 100 and 110 miles an hour to get from one to the other and get them all in by the end of the day. But we're going to do everything in our power to meet with everyone in this state. And then we'll let the chips fall where they fall at the end. So that was the approach.
At one point during the campaign, Ted Cruz and his staff became aware that you had a punk rock past and in some ways tried to weaponize it. What was your reaction to that?
You know, I don't even remember. I mean, I remember them, you know, trying to weaponize so many different things about me and my life and, you know, what's characteristic of me. But, you know, I think they were playing by that playbook, you know, that said, this is what a candidate's supposed to look like. This is what he or she is supposed to sound like. These are the things that are safe to say. And this is the career you have to have had before you've run for office. I mean, you were an attorney. You were in other government positions before this. You were this or that or the other. And being in a punk rock band didn't fit what was safe for politics, at least according to the conventional wisdom and the status quo. But what you find is that people are really sick and tired of the conventional wisdom and the status quo, and they want something different. It doesn't mean they themselves have to be punk rockers. It just means that they have to be open to doing this differently. And I found that people in Texas were, and it wasn't just limited to people of my party. I mean, independents, Republicans, folks who could give a shit about voting, all were in some way touched by this. And again, I want to be really clear, not by me and really not by anything that was, you know, essentially mine. It was this campaign and the people who made it happen and this movement that I was just lucky enough to be a part of in Texas. That very much reminded me of, you know, I don't know if you had this growing up, but, you know, in El Paso, in the punk rock culture, everyone's talking about the scene and, you know, saving the scene and, you know, what's the status of the scene today? But it's describing the community of people who are into punk rock and playing in bands and supporting shows and putting them on. And there was very much this scene or this community, but statewide and in Texas that people really wanted to be a part of. By the end of the campaign, more than 20,000 people in the state of Texas had picked up a clipboard to go knock on doors of complete strangers to talk to them about the campaign that we were running and to ask them to vote for me in November of 2018. And it produced the largest voter turnout in Texas history, and especially young people. Mm-hmm. Their voter turnout increased 500% in early voting over the last midterm election. So I think kind of defying that conventional wisdom, although we didn't do it for any calculated reason, ended up being the right or smart way to do this.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think people are looking for a less polished, vulnerable candidate But unfortunately, in 2016, people voted toward the outsider, and we have a situation now that literally every day we seem to be inundated with what is. I wake up and it's just like shitty Christmas. Like, what is in the news today?
Right.
You're a positive person. You're an optimist. How do you deal and stay positive when there's such a tornado of horseshit happening at a regular interval?
Yeah, that's the best description I've heard so far of what is happening. It is this blizzard of bizarre behavior from the president, and you can't fully digest or comprehend the last act before you're smashed in the face with the next one. And it turns out to be absolutely genius, you know, an evil genius, but genius nonetheless, where you cannot pursue accountability or consequences for any number of things because there are just so many of them. And it's in some ways inured people to just how dangerous this guy is and just how badly he's undermined democracy, the Constitution, rule of law, really any future we have of fulfilling our potential and our promise that we've clearly never lived up to, right? We've never really lived out the words that we're all created equal and that we're all going to be treated equally under the law. But we'd also never stopped fighting for that, or at least some people had never stopped fighting for that. And there was at least the illusion that progress was being made. And all of that is, I think, on the line right now and could potentially be lost forever. And I'm not, you know, it sounds like hyperbole, but you know, you wonder how democracies descend into dictatorships and how otherwise, you know, enlightened people, well-educated people, people with a proud history of achievement and progress can do some truly horrific, barbaric things like putting little kids in cages who have just fled 2,000 miles from the deadliest, most brutal countries on planet Earth, seeking asylum in this, a country of asylum seekers and refugees and immigrants. The fact that six of those kids have lost their lives so far in our custody and care, the fact that their parents were deported back to their country of origin, you know, that's a stain on our conscience as a country. And each of us will be accountable for what we did or failed to do in the face of that. And so, you know, you ask, how do you not descend into despair and just say, you know what, fuck it, man. This is bigger than me, bigger than anything I can do. I
feel
can't
helpless.
Keep up.
Yeah.
I feel helpless. And a lot of people, let's acknowledge, do. And a lot of people are in a much, much tougher situation than I am. I mean, 13,000 people have died in Texas from COVID. And it's not hitting all communities equally. I mean, you know, you go down to the Rio Grande Valley, 90 to 95% Mexican American, and they've run out of space in the morgues and the funeral homes, and they're stacking dead bodies in refrigerated FEMA trailer trucks because so many people are dying because our government will not issue a stay-at-home order and save lives, and they won't let the county judge in Hidalgo County or Cameron County or Starr County issue stay-at-home orders and save the lives of those constituents they serve and they represent. So I can understand someone who's like, you know what, this shit just does not work for me, does not family. I give up. But we can't, and I can't. And I have, you know, the privilege or the opportunity not to give up, and I'm going to make the absolute most of it. And so the antidote to despair, and I think the key to victory, is, you know, that old, you know, black flag maxim of get in the van, of what can I do today? And what we've been doing, we started an organization called Powered by People. And essentially, we've reached back out to those 20,000 plus volunteers. And we've said, what if all of us now, instead of getting behind a single candidate or a campaign, what if we get behind Democrats across the board in the state of Texas who are running to win the state house? And the state house controls the districts that are drawn and could, with Democratic majority, break down the racial gerrymandering, the voter ID laws, all of the things imposed to keep black and brown Texans from actually participating in our democracy. And what if, as we phone bank for these candidates and we text bank for these candidates and we write postcards to voters for these candidates, and by the way, we've made more than 24 million voter contact attempts just in Texas so far, what if in doing this, we're able to expand and enlarge the electorate and not only elect a Democratic majority to the state house, which is critical, but help to make Joe Biden the first Democratic nominee to win the Electoral College vote in Texas since 1976. It's been 44 years since a Democrat last won the state of Texas. If that happens, holy shit, it is a completely different game in this country. If the election is close, and even if Joe Biden has lawfully won it, make no mistake, Donald Trump will use however close that contest is to invite confusion and chaos and attempt to steal the election. He's already signaled the ways in which he's going to do it. But if Texas comes in with its 38 electoral college votes for Joe Biden on November 3rd or whenever the votes are finally tallied, you know, Donald Trump might not accept the results, but the rest of the country will be forced to. And the impact, I think, will be seismic. And it will forever reorder the political landscape and what is possible in America. And if we want Joe Biden, as unlikely as he might have been at the outset of this campaign, and if I was a big Joe Biden fan at the outset, I wouldn't have run for president myself. But as unlikely as it might be, I think he could very well have an FDR-like administration that confronts not just COVID and not just the worst recession since the Great Depression, but the single greatest existential threat to our existence, you know, climate change, gun violence in America that takes 100 lives a day, every single day and counting. The fact that in Texas, the largest provider of mental health care services is the county jail system, to the point that people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder literally, in some cases, try to get arrested on purpose to go to the one place where they're guaranteed help and medication. I want to fix all that shit. And the only way to do it is to actually make these phone calls and help to raise these volunteers and to pursue these victories with everything in my being. And that makes me happy. That gives me function. That gives me purpose. To quote Fugazi, function is the key, right? I have to have a role in this and in the country's future, right? And you mentioned, you know, punk rock not having sidelines. You don't sit it out. You are an active participant if you're in punk rock, whether you're in the band or in the audience. And democracy is that way. You don't get a pass. You don't get to sit it out or sit on the sidelines. All of us, you know, the privilege of living in a democracy requires the price of active participation. And so whether that's voting or helping other people to register to vote or running for office or supporting someone who is, that for me is deeply, deeply fulfilling. And so that's my antidote to despair.
Mm. All right. I'm already feeling invigorated. Thank you, Beto. I'm in a country where about 30 years ago, there was a mass shooting. And the government at that point took the initiative to do a gun buyback. And essentially, any gun fatalities for the last few decades are in low double digits. Almost nothing. When there's gun violence here in Australia, it is huge news because it is so rare. What do you think needs to happen, not only maybe in Texas, but also in the United States, to start making progress on reducing the number of gun-related deaths?
Yeah. I mean, I think your question held the answer. You've got to look at those best practices that have been proven to reduce gun violence and gun fatalities. I mean, you know, I mentioned the 100 who die by a gun every day in this country. Many of them are using that gun on themselves. If you had a universal background check, if you had what is known as an extreme risk protection order or red flag law. So, you know, if this guy who I go to school with is not acting right, and I know he owns a firearm, there's got to be some recourse for me to say, look, that gun has to be taken away from him because I think he's a danger to himself or he's a danger to me or someone else in this classroom. And literally that option doesn't exist in so much of the country. Ending the sale of weapons that were designed for the exclusive purpose of killing people. They weren't designed to hunt. They weren't designed for self-protection. They were designed to slaughter people on a battlefield. And the fact that we still sell them in the United States is so immoral and unconscionable. And yet it's happening. And then, you know, I took no small amount of shit for saying this, even from allies of mine in the gun sense movement, but I say it because it's true, not because it's easy. We should buy back every single one of those weapons of war that are out there in the United States, because each one of them is a potential instrument of terror. And, you know, a year and a month ago in El Paso, Texas, guy walks into a Walmart on the Saturday before school starts. So every mom and grandmother, every parent and grandparent is there with their kids and grandkids, buying the notebooks and the backpacks and the shoes and everything to get ready for the school year. This guy walks in with an AK-47 and wearing tactical gear, and he's got the, you know, earmuffs or whatever to deaden the sound and the shooting glasses, and just opens fire and ends up killing 23 people, ends up killing dads in front of their kids, ends up killing grandparents in front of their grandkids, hunts down little kids who thankfully by and large were protected by the adults and the staff at that Walmart, and leaves grievously injured so many dozens more. Now that guy had purchased this AK-47 online legally. And when that firearm came in, his mom, because he's a young guy, his mom calls the police in Allen, Texas. And she's like, please help me out here. My son just ordered this weapon of war that he has no need for. And I'm really concerned about him. And I'm worried about how he might use it. And the officer who takes the call says, I'm sorry, ma'am. He's perfectly within his rights and within the law to do this. Nothing we can do to help you out. And soon after, he drives 600 miles across Texas to El Paso to kill, as he later told police, he wanted to kill Mexicans, and he wanted to kill immigrants, and he wanted to kill this invasion that he'd been warned about by Donald Trump, who refers to immigrants and asylum seekers and refugees as an invasion, as an infestation, as animals. These are all words that he has used, dehumanizing words that you would find in the Third Reich, that you would hear out of the mouth of Adolf Hitler, that you would not expect to hear in this country, whose very existence is only made possible by the fact that we are a people of the planet over who have found a home right here in the United States. And yet this guy, keyed up by this president and, you know, tapping the deep well of racial hatred that has long existed in this country, perpetrates the largest mass killing of Mexican Americans and Latinos in the history of this country. And so that act alone should compel us to do the politically difficult but very necessary thing of ensuring no one has those weapons. And one other thing I want to say that I just think is so important. When you see these white men, these thugs, in the battle gear and the weapons of war, standing outside of state capitals, and in some instances, like they did in Michigan, actually, because our laws are so fucked up in this country, being allowed to take those weapons into the chamber where the state representatives are voting on, you know, the priorities for their communities, their state, and our country, that is terrorism. To use the threat of violence or force or death to try to compel a lawmaker to change course, that's my understanding of terrorism. And it should be no accident that we saw in Kenosha a 17-year-old with one of these weapons of war shoot and kill people in that community. Again, a young man inspired by Donald Trump. So it's not as though this is some act of God or, you know, something like a hurricane that we have no control over. These are man-made problems, human-made problems that have a human solution. And we just have to have the courage to pass and enforce those human solutions.
So what's your recommendation when one of the listeners is having a conversation with someone who does identify a little bit more with the right on some of those issues?
I think you've always got to be open to engagement. And in fact, I think you've got to seek it out. And that was a lesson I drew from traveling across Texas as a candidate for the United States Senate, talking about an assault weapons ban in not just Austin, Texas, and El Paso, and San Antonio, and the places where it's safe to talk about that, but doing so in deeply red rural communities where beyond its function and use, that weapon represents something perhaps culturally to people, and being open to that and understanding that and listening. But by that same token, not making the mistake that Democrats have made for the last 30 some odd years, which is essentially allowing the NRA and the Republicans and the most, you know, rabid dynamic of the gun lobby to set the terms of the debate and the parameters of what is possible. And I feel like, you know, we have come to this place not only because of Republicans who are in the pocket of the NRA, but because of Democrats who fear to say what is true and what is necessary. And so I think if both parties in that conversation, you know, the person who thinks they should have an AR-15 and not have to go through a background check and be able to carry it in public and be able to storm the state house steps with it to intimidate other people, you know, hear that guy out. Likely it's going to be a guy, and likely it's going to be a white guy.
Well, you got to listen to him. They have a weapon.
Right. But don't be cowed by that. Don't be afraid of that. And you yourself have to share why it is so important to make sure that he does not have that weapon, because, you know, link it in my case to what I saw happen in my community, the slaughter of my fellow El Pasoans, what we know happens throughout this country, and the very real fear that so many of our fellow Americans live in, that they're not going to make it home at the end of the day. You know, I think, I'll tell you what, I went to a gun show in Arkansas in the middle of the presidential campaign, and I had just announced my platform on guns, which included a mandatory buyback of AR-15s. And so I walk into this gun show in rural Arkansas, and, you know, they're selling AR-15s and AK-47s, and I got into some really good conversations. And I'll tell you, one guy came up to me and he said, "Look, Beto, I hear you. I've got kids in school as well, and I'm really afraid that one day they're not going to come home. And I know we've got to do something better than what we're doing now. And I own an AR-15, and look, I'm selling them here right now. So I recognize that what we're doing is not working." And he went beyond the typical talking points of, you know, it's all video games and it's Hollywood and, mm-hmm. you know, there's not enough God in our school and this craziness. And he was willing to acknowledge that the number and types of guns that we have in this country is absolutely correlated to the amount of death that we've accepted so far. So, you know, those kind of conversations happening across this country a million times over are really important. But ultimately, I really do think it comes down to political power and having the majorities necessary to do what is impossible when you have the intransigence of one party that not only will not pass gun safety laws in Texas, they not only didn't pass gun safety laws, they passed 10 laws in last legislative session that made guns more available and allowed you to take them into more places like schools, like churches, like businesses that specifically say, "Do not bring a gun in here." You now have statutory protection in some instances to take that gun into that business. So that's what brings me back to the work that I'm doing now that is so fulfilling is, you know, let's have those conversations. Let's listen to people, but then let's win some fucking elections and have a majority that will do the right thing, because, you know, we don't have a lot of time on a lot of these issues, whether it's climate or guns or healthcare. We got to get moving.
Mm. So you've got Powered by People. How can people participate?
So, you know, the best way, if you're interested in helping us reach the Texas voters who are going to decide the outcome of the most important election of our lifetimes in the biggest battleground state in the United States, if you want to join us in that work, and it's not easy, and it's a grind, and it's tough to call complete strangers and talk to them about, you know, one of the two issues you're never supposed to bring up in polite company, politics. But if you're willing to do that because you understand just how important this is, you can go to our website. It is poweredbypeople.org, but it's spelled kind of funky. It is spelled powered and then xpeople.org, poweredxpeople.org. And you'll see, you can go to the events tab. You'll see a list of phone banks we have coming up. And Nate, you'll be happy to know we had someone 2 weeks ago from Australia who was phone banking for us. I don't know what time of morning or night it was for her, But she was willing to do that. And we have folks, you know, who've signed up from every one of the 50 states and many outlying countries, expatriate Americans, others who just know how important this election is for Texas, for the country, and for the world. So we'd love to have the help.
Absolutely. And I'll definitely be putting that that URL in this episode page. People volunteer, please go to peoplexpowered.org. So Beto, we're going to be wrapping up here shortly. Before we leave, let's talk a little bit about your current playlist. What kind of music is inspiring you at the moment?
Oh, wow. I just picked up a record by a guy named Joe Ely. And I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's this really important figure in Texas music, and I'm learning in American music, and I'm learning in just rock and roll globally. He was in a band called the Flatlanders in Lubbock, Texas. Has this amazing 1977 solo album that's an eponymous debut. And he's playing a show in London in 77, and finishes the show, and the Clash are in his dressing room. And he has no clue who the Clash are, but they become fast friends. They end up touring together. He brings the Clash back out to West Texas. You know, the Clash cover this West Texas hit called I Fought the Law that was written by Sonny Curtis of the Crickets and made popular by Bobby Fuller of El Paso, Texas in like 1964, 1965. You hear Joe Ely on Should I Stay or Should I Go, the backing Spanish language vocals. That's Joe Ely and Joe Strummer belting that out. And Joe Ely just wrote this album in the midst of this quarantine called Love in the Midst of Mayhem. And it's beautiful, it's haunting, and it's got all that history, including his role in kind of bridging Tejano country, rock and roll, roots rock, and punk rock. And so that's been something I've been playing a lot of. Jim Ward, a fellow El Pasoan, and his band Sparta just put out an album called Trust the River, which I love, and I've been playing a lot of, and I ordered the vinyl of it, which I rarely do. The older I get, the less vinyl I'm ordering, but I made an exception. There's another El Paso artist, Ziemba, who is just making some really amazing music, and I've been listening to her songs as they've been released, and the record's coming out in a couple of days. So those are three West Texas gems that I offer to you and your listeners to pick up. Music's really helping me get through life right now. And I tell you what, I end up returning back to the stuff I was listening to, you know, in my teen years when I first kind of discovered the power of music, you know, Sonic Youth's album, Evil, the Minutemen, Double Nickels on the Dime, that first Bad Brains record. I you know, sometimes I'm like, what am I doing listening to this stuff I was playing when I was 16 or 17 years old? Am I just doing it for sentimental value or because it's comforting? No, it's because the music is just amazing and it holds up, you know, 30 plus years later. So all that stuff's in the mix.
Mm-hmm. You still have your vinyl collection? You have a stash somewhere in the house?
Yeah, I've got one. Part of it behind me, you know, over the years, I was moving around so much. I lived in New York after college, moved back to El Paso, and, you know, going from apartment to apartment, we just end up giving this stuff away. So I want to build that collection back up again. And I was listening to your interview with Henry Rollins, who's just kind of been a hero of mine, especially when I was growing up, and listening to the care that he takes and how he purchases records and stores them and catalogs them and databases them. And I'd love to, you know, to aspire someday to take that kind of care of the collection I have, but it's one that I'm building up over time.
Okay. So you still have the records from back in the day, but they're a little bit more well-loved, I think what you say.
That's right. That's right. I have not taken good care of them. And there's some classics that I would love to have in my collection that, you know, for whatever reason now I'm reduced to listening to them, you know, on, you know, a YouTube video, which is silly. And I need to sit down and take the time to order them or go to a record store better and go buy them once those record stores open up again.
All right, Beto, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us this great insight into really the connections of punk and politics and really being authentic to oneself. And I think that's really the theme that I've witnessed, not only in your career, but in the successful careers of people who are trying to change the way that we live and better humanity. I want to highly recommend people participate in the process. Your cost of entry is your ability to participate. Go to poweredxpeople.org, sign up, and let's help flip Texas this November. Again, Beto, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide.
I love talking with you. Thanks for having me on. Really
anytime,
appreciate
mate.
It.
All right, there we go. Mr. Beto O'Rourke, ladies and gentlemen. Man, I gotta tell you, he knows his stuff. He went deep into the SST catalog. I haven't heard the name Slovenly in years. But man, a great reminder. Revisited that album. Boy, he's bang on with that one. So, again, thank you, Beto. And everyone, poweredxpeople.org. You can volunteer your time. If you don't got no time, you can always donate money. But whatever it is, do your part to make a difference in this election. That's poweredxpeople.org. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. You know, we got another 200-something episodes available. Interviews with artists, record talk, music, fan nerddom, trivia, all that stuff. Check out The Vinyl Guide on all podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Sonnet, wherever you get your podcasts, that's where we're at. So we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.